Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hi, welcome to today's event, conversation with Barry Lopez. If you're here, make your way into the seats, or you can crowd surf across them. My name is John Freeman. I'll be Barry's interlocutor. I once asked Barry Lopez the earliest thing he could remember, and without missing a beat, he spoke for a long time about water. Dude likes water. He spoke about being transfixed by the luminescence of a thin column of water as it poured from a spigot at his house in San Fernando Valley. He would have been just a few years old, already separated from his birth father, the son of a single mother, already sensing then beauty's power to hold you. The way, too, that we all need something vital from nature. Give it time and water builds our world, patiently, sometimes ferociously. It gives life, and in its reflection, sometimes we see ourselves. The writer about to join me on stage shares a lot of these qualities, as if his spirit were written in water all those years ago. For the past half century, Barry Lopez has traveled the world, treading carefully on distant landscapes, interacting respectively with native cultures, observing, sometimes terrifyingly closely, the behavior of wild animals. He's a seeker in the old sense, trying to find meaning in a world we inherited and increasingly are destroying. Is there a writer alive who has assembled so many story cultures into himself and allowed himself to be remade by them? In his 20s, Lopez assembled a book of Navajo trickster stories. His first work of fiction, Desert Notes, is like a book on the American desert written by Castaneda, or Cortazar. Of Wolves and Men, his classic 1978 book on our relationship with Canis Lupus juxtaposes Native American folklore about the wolf and the tales of field biologists. Arctic Dreams, his classic 1986 National Book Award winner, is saturated in all the ways of knowing that region of the world are often captured by, and reminds us that the imagination enters where there is a gap between knowing and not knowing, and that often in that gap, the truth about landscape exists. Lopez's equal sensitivity to the vast lacunae which exist in human knowledge and his grasp for what has been assembled make him an extraordinary guide, a lamplit person in a world made by destruction. In this spirit, he wrote The Great Rediscovery of North America, has given birth to dozens of fictional characters existing on this precipice, a moral one, he would argue, between states of being and knowing and not knowing. So much of Lopez's worldview unfolds on the move while traveling out there, even if it's in his own backyard in Oregon, seeking answers, not answers, but questions bigger that we can live with inside. What aren't we asking? How does this journey change a person? What are the pleasures of collaborating with people in search of such engagement? What exactly are the causes of our despair in our world? And how do we resist that despair? These are the questions driving Lopez's brand new book, Horizon, which wrestles again and again with the frames we've put around the grand questions we pose of ourselves. Who are we? Why are we here? What is good? What is justice? It's been gestated, he said, for over 25 years, written over the last five of them, a book that is narrated with restorative complexity, a traveler's life in search of better ways to understand the umbrellas the big questions make for us. And what a lot of ground it covers. A partial list of coordinates from which Lopez sends dispatches include the Bering Strait, West Antarctica, Cape Foulweather, Botany Bay, Afghanistan, Kenya, Tanzania, the Falklands, South Georgia, Idaho, Auschwitz, the Canadian Arctic, the Grand Canyon, New York City, and vicariously the Mariana Trench, some 7 miles down beneath the surface of the ocean. Threading these journeys together are stories of other fellow seekers, not just the archaeologists and paleobotanists and the biologists and the field guides and the fixers over whose shoulders Lopez gently looks, but they're the explorers themselves, men, and they are often men, like Columbus, and Captain Cook, whose legacy and achievements Lopez measures with monumental clarity, as well as someone I hope we talk about today, Ronald McDonald. No, not that one. The mestizo explorer who managed to gain entry to Japan when it was a closed society. Each long chapter pries open vast, almost Bierstadtian spaces, minus the assumption of dominion. Acres of narrative space made by three-dimensional by Lopez's evocations of history, native culture, personal anecdote, and exquisite sensory detail. If anything else, you will enjoy this book for its colors. What a palette. Prune, oxidized copper, the white of church linen, barrel green, not to mention Lopez's enormous and sensuous and often antique vocabulary. Who, after all, in the recent Scrabble game has deployed Zarek, or Rill, or Talus, or Tombolo? Bowing us across oceans of time and spaces we have taken too much for granted, Lopez is our navigator. Our navigator in a time looking for one. Read this book slowly and you will pause in the enormity of what it asks of you, what it shows you, and feel a tiny bit like Lopez himself, a man standing there like a sparrow on the floor of a cathedral with its roof gone. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the man who took the roof off, Barry Lopez. So now that I've said your name, let's take it away. I was rereading Of Wolves and Men recently, and the one thing I took away from that book was your intense desire not to see the wolf through your eyes necessarily, or human eyes, but to see the wolf as the wolf behaves as an animal. And I feel like one thing this book is doing is saying, is trying to take that same lens off your own eyes, looking at yourself. And so we begin the book not using necessarily the first person. You describe a boy, the boy. And it's an interesting technique of narrative estrangement. And I wonder, the question is this technique purely for storytelling reasons, or is that narrative estrangement part of your life as a traveler?
You know, we say this all the time, I've always wanted to do this or believe that or something, but you just colonize your own past, trying to see a through line backward. I do think that it's been driven into me that the story is the important thing. We don't need you, or we need you in the form that the storyteller has always taken throughout human history. So please stay out of the way. This book was very difficult for me to write because I thought addressing the topics that I chose, I couldn't. It was not fair to the reader for me to just be in the background. I had to say, well, this is who I am, and this is what I've been thinking. But putting myself out there like that was nerve-wracking. And I think one reason it took sort of an extra year to write the book is that I was not comfortable talking about myself, but I understood as a writer, you either have to do this or the book will be a failure. I have always liked the technique of disappearing, if it is a technique. It's just my personality, I think. Because the reader is searching for an experience between herself and a story, not between herself and you and a story. And I particularly tried to pay attention to that with Arctic Dreams. I just wanted to put my hand in the small of somebody's back and push them into the scene, and they'd forget about me, and it would be them and what they were seeing. And that's what you want them to take away. I talked to Eduardo Galeano, who we lost once, about this, and we both agreed, we had the same philosophy, I guess, that you're the servant. The writer is the servant. The writer is not an important person. It's the story that's important, and the service is to the reader, who in sometimes very serious ways, in some ways only incidentally, is lost. So if your conceit is that you will help the reader, then you must pay attention to exactly what you're doing. The mellifluous flow of lyrical language is not enough.
It reminds me that there is no such thing as flamboyantly good manners. Because if you actually have good manners, you're kind of often invisible. But moving on, a lot of this book, I mentioned this litany of places that you are sending dispatches from. A lot of it takes place in your own backyard. And I wonder if you can talk about why.
Well, you know, you have to answer certain questions when you're someone who travels a lot. And one of them is, what is your favorite spot? And, you know, if you could had your choice, where would you go to die or something? nowhere. The way I try to explain it is, I have a conversation with every place I go, and it's deliberate. I see this connection between the human desire for intimacy, which is something all of us feel to a greater or lesser extent. And in order to achieve intimacy, you have to become vulnerable. You have to be unafraid to look unsophisticated or foolish. And it's only then, when you become vulnerable, that you make this connection. You present yourself, you trust the situation, you make yourself vulnerable, and then this landscape, figurative and real, opens up. And, you know, in another figurative way, you're in that lovemaking process of back and forth. So I think we have a kind of folklore that in order to discover whatever, you've got to go away from your home ground. And we forget that the discovery comes on your home ground after you've gone out. You know, walkabout is about coming home. So when I sit in the woods at my house, I fortunately stumbled into this house 49 years ago and have been there ever since, because it provides me a conversation that I can pick up again and again and again and again and again for years. Salmon spawn on gravel bars in front of the house, and beaver have burrows in the north bank of the Mackenzie River right in front of the house, and deer and elk and black bear and foxes, everybody moves through. And I've felt it's part of my caretaker responsibility to make sure that the things that unsettle them don't get near them. And I guess in my sort of adolescent mind, you know, there's a give and take with them. And I want that conversation until I'm gone from the earth. And the only way I will get it is to stay there and make my bow of respect to everything living around me day after year after year. So I am trying to think about the large things that many of us feel we need to know or to explore, but I can do it figuratively at my home without missing a beat, I think. Sometimes it's not irritation, it's coming to grips with the reality of life when people come to visit. You've been at our house, and I find myself wanting to explain, you know, in the Western idiom, you're in church now. That's what this is. And I'd like you to meet some of the parishioners.
It's very dark outside at night in this part of the world. And for a guy that lives in New York City, it's a tiny bit terrifying when you say the church parishioners might come, and it will include some bear and elk. I didn't sleep much that night. I was laying in bed thinking, there's a bear that's going to come right in front of that window and look at me. And did you, when you first landed there, did you think, I'm an interloper? And how did you take the edge off that feeling?
I've been trying to do that. I always feel like an interloper there. You know, I talked to Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson, the Harvard biologist, once about this, and he was expressing to me his frustration going to a National Geographic meeting about, you know, where do we go next, and what do we write about? And he said the attitude in the room among senior editors and staff was that everything had pretty much been discovered, and so now where do we go? You know, which sounds like inanity to me, and did to him. So I told him that I have a deck 12 feet by 12 in the woods. I love how clean the space is, and I like to walk around. There's nothing on there but a prie-dieu, you know, a kneeler, and just use the open space to bleed off the ordinary fears of everyday life. And make yourself open. So I read out there, sometimes set a chair up and I read. And every summer for all of these years, I'll be in the middle of a book, and a little bug I have never seen before will trundle across the page and disappear. So every summer, a new species. So if you're going to tell me, you know, it's all a sucked orange, I'm going to say, you know, I don't think so. I think there's quite a bit to discover. You're stuck in your own sense of scale. What's big is important, what's small is innocuous. That's not right.
The book has these long, almost symphonic chapters where you are in a place and you often go away from that place and come back within the same chapter. So in Cape Foulweather, the long second chapter, you describe driving out to where Cook tried to land off the coast of Oregon.
Right.
You get in your truck, get out of your truck, pitch a tent, and then the chapter orbits around that location, but it goes many other places. And in that chapter, use this phrase, I might be misremembering it, but it's something like the sentience of landscape. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, because in that chapter, you're looking at landscape and you're trying to absorb it and you're using different tools. You're looking through a telescope, you're looking around you, you're touching things. But tell me what the sentience of a landscape means to you.
I think when you come into a remote village, there's always suspicion about you, primarily because you're white and because you're not with other people. Traditional people are always a little bit put off by somebody who doesn't arrive with their family and who is interested in asking questions but is not interested in talking to children. So the only way you will ever become, that you will be able to learn beyond the reach of your own intellect is by understanding that these two are sophisticated people and they're sensitive to the expression of your body and the tone of your voice, and the key to any kind of conversation is always respect. People who feel you don't respect them or see them as equals don't feel any motivation to communicate with you. But if you come and you indicate that you understand that you don't know very much and that you're here to learn another way of knowing. You want to become immersed in another epistemology. There's usually a welcome. So for me, sentience is something we talk about with regard to people. But if we, you know, there's a pattern of emancipation in Western culture, and the ones who are still waiting for emancipation are animals. They can't do these things for themselves. That business of being released from the definition given to you by the other is an important part of any relationship. And so the frame of mind that I maintain because I want to learn is to believe that the landscape knows you're there. And then if you respect the place, which means, for example, you know, when that scene at the in the Alexandra Lowland on Skraeling Island, where I just take a long time, just sit for a long time. I think that it's not curiosity, but I think the land feels about you that you're knocking on the door, and if you don't bang on the door or you don't force the door, there is a possibility that you'll be incorporated into the moment. So, yes, I do. I think it's a good frame of mind to be in, to know that a landscape knows that you're there and it's watching you to see what kind of being you are. Are you possessive or arrogant or self-important? If there's not some breakdown between your sense of self and the larger world, I don't think you're attractive to the landscape. The land doesn't see any point in entering into a relationship with you.
This is why the bear didn't eat me.
We had a talk with the bear before you and Nicole got there. Leave these guys alone.
you just mentioned time, and one of the... I don't use this lightly in the Californian way, but one of the truly awesome things about this book is the way that each chapter is trying to pry open dimensions.
Yeah.
You know, trying to find a third dimension. And I think a lot of it has to do with, and you can correct me or you can expand on this, is your sense of how to make time bigger.
Yes.
And can you talk about that and what that means in the face of some of the questions that we're dealing with right now?
Well, we're dealing with really big questions, life-killing stuff. And I sense in myself and in my friends and people met in some corner of the world that people are really afraid. And the anxiety would be like being in the bottom of a funnel instead of at the top, where you feel daily, almost without let up, the pressure of bad people, bad policies, and lethal behavior. So it doesn't seem to me to make sense that the same people who got us into this situation financially, politically, psychologically, will be the ones to figure out how to get us out. So we have to find out how to get out of this bad place and think clearly. So part of what I'm doing when I'm traveling is talking to other women and men who have thought about bad stuff coming. And it's possible to say, well, what do you think? What can we do? What are your thoughts about that? And if you do that for a long time, you see that your own culture is missing out because it is essentially racist. It in the abstract, it believes that we know and others don't really. They need help. When in fact, it's probably the other way around. So, listening to other people, indicating that there's something here about common cause, puts you on that road to breaking with these old, rigid, and now useless, I think, 19th century ideas like the nation state, all of which prevent the coming together of the really gifted among us, which traditional people refer to as elders. Of course, these are not just older people. They're a very special kind of human being. So we're prevented from dealing with the trouble that we have because we insist on criteria for people who will be invited to the table that are just ridiculous, like having a university degree, for example. Some people go through that system and come out open to the world, and others come out believing that the world is an it, and they are the only sentient being there. So I think what I was consciously trying to do, you know, you've seen enough of this to know exactly what I'm talking about, but you think you know what you're doing as a writer, but you don't, not at the deep level, you know. You have an idea and you work with it to the point of breaking down in tears. And what you're trying to do in some ways is open up the conversation, open up the space so that people don't feel terrified and frozen, paralyzed with fear. So I think in every chapter in the book, I am literally trying to do that, to push sideways, push forward and backward, push up, push down, create a lot more space so that somebody can sit there like an afternoon tea in the sunshine with wind blowing in the leaves lightly, that kind of atmosphere, and think about what how to frame the questions they want to ask. In order to do that, you can't, a person can't absorb sirens and the hustle and bustle, as we used to say, of a city environment. You have to be separated from the things that demand your attention but treat you like you're just an innocuous thing in its way. So there is, I was conscious, for example, that I very much wanted to talk about diving, about scuba diving and being 150 feet under the surface, you know, there in the Galapagos, watching these big walls of hammerhead sharks moving past us. And the same thing in Antarctica, diving under the ice and dealing with what looks like the depauperate biological life of the land. And at and the ice, you're looking at 100 to 150,000 organisms per square meter. So it's a very different situation in the water just there in the offshore. So I wanted that opening up underneath the surface of the land. And then, you know, in Antarctica, I was determined to fly kites because it opened up the space around us in camp. It was difficult because, you know, at 25 below zero, if you cramp your hands on the handles of an acrobatic kite, you can do that for just 5 or 6 or 7 minutes, and then you can't, the cold is too much. So a friend of mine and I devised this system where we would fly an acrobatic kite, and then when you were nearing the breaking point, the other guy would come up between your arms and take the handles, and you could let the handles go and recover, and then, you know, it was fun. And I used to say to myself that, you know, there's nobody here. There's no birds flying over. There's no animals here at all. but us. But the wind seemed to be an animal with many of the characteristics of a wild animal. So flying the acrobatic kite was a way to get to know the only other animal.
There are parts of this book where Barry begins in his own self-effacing way to resemble James Bond in the 1970s. Do you remember when he drove those little tiny bubble helicopters? I was keeping a tab of the vehicles that you ride in, and I stopped at around 15 or 20. But they include a Chinook helicopter, a Twin Otter. There's the Martin M130, which you don't ride in, but you have a model of. And I don't think it's accidental. And I wonder if you can talk a tiny bit about, you know, as a kind of small E explorer slash searcher, and you're writing about how movement through the world and interaction with cultures different than your own expand horizons and allow you to ask big questions. There's a tiny bit of tribute threaded through to the means of conveyance, if you will.
Right.
And I wonder if you can talk about that in a world in which the means of conveyance conveniently have also destroyed our world and how you balance those two things.
Well, I don't think that, you know, every one of us does something that's a little bit half crazy. You know, we do not recycle everything. We do not follow through on every level with leading a good life, ecologically speaking. And the corridor that I go down is my fascination with vehicles or conveyances. And it was that way when I was 6 or 7 or 8 years old. And in that way that your mind takes an idea that it has an affection for or an affiliation with and just lets it grow for 20 or 40 or 50 years or whatever, I'm always watching the things that make you move farther, faster, deeper in the ocean, higher. I don't know why I'm attracted to them, but they have a mesmerizing quality to me. I talk about the scene in the book when I was staying in a hotel in Lodwar in northern Kenya. I told you last night, $4 a night. No amenities. So I got dropped off in Lodwar by some men I was working with, and I was going out of the hotel to go to the place that people recommended for dinner, and I saw this immaculate, huge, four-wheel drive, ton-and-a-half or two-ton Mercedes-Benz cross-country truck with twin 40-gallon diesel tanks, winch in the back, winch in the front, etc. And I crawled over it like an ant, trying to figure out from the outside what made it special. You know, how deep could it go in a moving river without flooding carburetor, for example. And then I looked around the way you do to make sure nobody was staring at you, and stepped up on the rung of the step to mount into, to get into the cab. And I didn't open the door, but I looked at the two transmission shifters long enough to figure out how many gears were there. So I just went kind of sideways for a while with this truck and where I could go. And I went to dinner with another book of maps and laid them out on the table and started bisecting the northern part, which used to be called the frontier, the northern frontier in Kenya. And I was just lost for an hour with it. So it's a predilection. Conveyances are something that attracts me. I like to play with them and see how they work and what would you use them for. And, you know, at a certain point in your life, I think for a writer, everything is figurative. everything is metaphorical. So you're not, in fact, you're not endorsing any kind of technology. You're just playing with an idea. I want to go. Well, how would you go? So that's what's going on there. But my overmind, I guess, was concerned throughout the book with this. We're all troubled. We're all frustrated. Many of us are paralyzed. We all feel wounded. So how do we get out of here? How do we get out of here? Well, the figurative answer is you've got to have a conveyance, a boat or a plane or something. And what do you imagine that would be? So that's the first part of the problem of addressing global climate change, and I think, and everything else. You know, obviously, you're not going to go away from global climate change. It's not what I'm talking about. So you can get to a point where you think you understand what that word conveyance means and how it plays at several different levels in society and in daily life. And what would be to take a better approach to entrenched problems? What would be the shape of the thing, the conveyance that would be suitable? And then the other problem is, who's going to be the navigator? We don't seem to have any, or we've followed charismatic navigators who are self-centered, foolish, and deadly. So what are we going to do for a navigator? And that's why I talk about James Cook so much. He was a racist. Yes, he was a colonizer. Yes, there were a lot of things that we find despicable today embodied in James Cook. But given the time that he grew up in, and the pressures on him, I think he did a reasonably good job of getting a conveyance and navigating in places where we'd never navigated before. And he shaped for us what the world really looked like. It wasn't speculation after Cook. It was, everything was pin-downable. Find a place, get a latitude and longitude, you could find it again. Before him, that wasn't the case. You could maybe find it again.
Yes, you remind us the extraordinariness of that feat. I wonder, since this is such a beautifully written book, if you could read a tiny section of it where you use the navigator for the first time. Are you
with the Hanseatic? The ship and
the ship. Yeah,
straight. Yeah.
This will give you at least a passing impression for just the idiocy of some of the things that Barry does, as well as the wonder. I'll just leave it at that.
As far back as I can remember, I've had a deep fear of being caught in hurricane weather or heavy seas out of sight of land. Even though I've found the sea seen from shore in almost any weather mesmerizing and soothing, perhaps its primary attraction has been its breadth, like a stage's, or the unbroken line of its meeting with the sky, or its inconstancy, or the transparency of its colors, from the dark purple of prunes through tropical blues to the blue of the verdigris that forms on oxidized copper. Once in Camden, Maine, walking its waterfront with a friend, the painter Alan McGee, I saw in a shop window a perfectly crafted scale model of a whaleboat, the type of longboat with a step mast that MacDonald would have. MacDonald's another person in the book. The type of longboat with a stepmast that MacDonald would have worked from, though I didn't know of him at the time. I bought the model because it was beautiful, and because it had been built with near microscopic attention to detail, the coiled lines, the oarlocks, the rigged harpoons, it was fashioned out of someone's love and perfect knowledge. I wanted it in the room where I worked, next to the model of the Martin M130, which is an amphibious aircraft. Today, the boat resides in my workroom in a glass box to keep dust from settling into its many small crevices. It's an image for me of courage, even of security. For a long while after I purchased it, I was not able to imagine the boat in the sort of seas I knew whalers had encountered, or to regard it as anything but unsafe. One day this perception changed in the Drake Passage, that corridor of notoriously wild water that separates the tip of South America from the Antarctic Peninsula. On that day, I learned about a kind of beauty I had not until then been able to grasp. I was aboard a large ecotourism vessel with 130 others trying to reach the leeward shore of South Georgia, 750 nautical miles southeast of Port Stanley, our point of departure in the Falkland Islands the day before. The ship, the Hanseatic, was weathering a Beaufort Force 11 storm, sustained winds over 55 knots, chaotic seas of 40-foot waves with some 50-footers breaking over the upper decks. Hardly a spot on the surface of the water was not blanketed with sea foam. Sometimes the bow of the Hanseatic was entirely buried in a wall of water. It geysered through the anchor chain's hawse holes and crashed against the windows of the bridge. For some reason, I decided this was the time for me to address my old fear. I stepped outside on a lee deck, just below the bridge, with a trusted friend, the polar explorer Will Steger. Dressed in storm gear, we stood together in the cauldron of soaking air, listening to the shrieking wind tear through the superstructure. We quickly hunkered in the shelter of a companionway with our feet spread and with death grips on the railing. We watched in astonishment as albatrosses 40 feet away navigated the chaotic wind like Olympic snowboarders, glancing over to make eye contact with us as they did. I turned at one point to see the stern of the 403-foot ship rise from the water and swing 30 feet to port. The only stillness here was the steel deck directly under our feet, which carried the shuddering of the ship as it crested into our thighs. Sometime into this spectacle, I realized I was relaxed, that thoughts were unfurling in my head in a normal way, without panic or anxiety. What had for so long been an image of terror for me was now an image of something else, a kind of perfection. Here was Earth's fundamental wildness. Here was William Blake's sense of the divine in chaos. A well-traveled friend of mine, whom I told of my fear of encountering big seas offshore, had said to me of just such a storm he'd been through in the Drake Passage, "I saw the face of God." When I got home from that trip, I looked differently at the whaleboat in the glass case. Its oars were shipped, its sails were raised, no human figure is aboard. I now sense the daring in its architecture. Imagine the seamanship that would keep it from capsizing in heavy weather. I could appreciate more deeply its integrity, which is chiefly what made it attractive. The subtlest memory of that hour I spent watching the storm from one of the Hanseatic's upper decks is that by standing that close to a force that might easily have killed me if I became inattentive, I'd fed both a sense of gratitude for still having, at the age of 57, a life I could lead, and a sense of forgiveness for the harm any random person might do to another. In those minutes of gazing at the boiling cistern of waves and watching the albatrosses addressing the storm with great seriousness, I could fix only on what I admired most often in other human beings, their enduring grace and poise. As I look back on Cook's experiences in the Pacific and on McDonald's, and look at the model of the M130 sitting in my studio, and consider my fascination with the nautical details of Cook's resolution, I can see that I've spent much of a lifetime thinking about such conveyances. When the time comes, what sort of person will be at the helm for us? And how will we know whether we can trust this navigator?
I'd like to say that's a crescendo in the book, but the whole book is written that way. So you really must avail yourself of it. You mentioned McDonald in that passage, and I mentioned him in my introduction. I wonder if you can tell the people here a little bit more about him, because Cook, I've read some books about, but I'd never heard of McDonald.
Nobody had ever heard of McDonald. I was in Spokane once, and I went into the Historical Society, the Eastern Washington Historical Society, and found a trove of letters and notebooks that were made by a man named Ranald McDonald. He was born in 1824 in Astoria at the mouth of the Columbia River. He had a Chinook mother, and his father was the Hudson Bay factor at the fort there at Astoria. He lived with the Chinook people, his people, I think until he was 10 or something like that. And then his father became the factor at Fort Vancouver, about 120 miles up the Columbia River. So he went there and he got schooled. And his father envisioned that he would become himself a factor. And while he was there, he had to deal with the fact that he wasn't white. So his father sent him off to Winnipeg to a Hudson Bay Company school, and he was severely chastised one time when he expressed an interest in dating a white woman. He was told in no uncertain terms that for a person like him, no. He did everything that his father asked him to do, the factor McDonald, and ended up in Ontario, working in a bank, doing drudge work, listening to people who told him if he just saved his money, then one day he could, whatever it was. And he at the age of about 16, he was fed up with the whole thing. He realized that because he was neither Chinook nor white, he wasn't going to be able to realize the dreams that his father had for him. It just wasn't going to happen. So he took what money he had. He went to Sag Harbor, a whaling town in Long Island, and signed on to a whaler. And he began the life of a seaman. He sailed over much of the world. And when he was a boy, he heard that some strange people had washed up on the shore of the state of Washington. These were Japanese sailors during the time that Japan was closed. Melville called Japan the double-bolted kingdom. Nobody got in, and shipbuilders were not allowed to build ocean-worthy ships, just coastal vessels. But storms would always dismast the fishing vessels and the trading vessels, and every once in a while one of them would end up in the currents in the North Pacific that brought it over a period of months to the shores of North America, to Vancouver Island or Washington most often. Most of the time there was nobody alive aboard. But with this ship, which was carrying rice, they had buckets to catch rainwater and they had rice. And of the 11 crewmen, I think 3 lived and came ashore alive after months at sea. Ranald McDonald became fascinated by who these people were, where they were from, and sort of what it all meant. And in his mind, when he understood that these were Japanese people and that they looked just like Indians, it struck him that the same thing that happened to his Chinook people was going to happen to these people, and somebody better warn them about what was coming for them. So eventually he wanted to go and warn them, and he made a deal with a whaler captain that once they had the hold full of sperm whale oil in the Sea of Japan, he would be put overboard in one of the whaling boats with some supplies and things, and then he would drift ashore in Hokkaido in northern Japan and present himself to Ainu people, indigenous people, and he would appear to be a shipwrecked sailor. And that would get him into Japan, even though he knew many American whaling ships had been destroyed there, and they had come, American sailors had come across, come into Japan and behaved in a horrible, condescending, drunken way before they were shipped out. He endeared himself to the Japanese people, and he ended up I can't recall the name of the town, it's very common, but he taught the shogun's court to speak English. And he told them, there is a force coming for you as it came for my people. And your shore cannons and your samurai are not going to be able to manage what's coming. So you must prepare yourselves. So we taught the group to speak English, and that's why 5 years later, I guess, when arrogant Admiral Perry came to Edo to confront the Japanese and say, open the door, the men he spoke to first, who he was surprised to see spoke English, were already informed about the hellfire that was coming. So he performed this really remarkable task, and historians marginalized and ignored him because he was a mestizo. And it seemed to me when I read the story that this was a story of what is going on for us now. A person with no standing because of his race and lack of formal education, etc., etc., was just pushed aside. So he ended up on the Colville Indian Reservation in northeastern corner of the state of Washington, and he died there alone. I went several times to his grave to talk to him and to tell him that he wasn't forgotten, and that we're dealing with the same problem that made him anxious today, which is racism and the refusal to bring people to the table who actually know what's going on and can help us. So that was Ranald McDonald. Ironically, of course, you know, he's got the McDonald thing going on with the hamburgers, which I think is perfect, you know. But so I came to think about the guys that get to go and say they went and talk about what they saw, James Cook, and the people who went and saw things that nobody ever saw and imagined things people weren't thinking about, which were coming, but were told, no, not you. So I would have this frame of mind about James Cook and Ranald McDonald. And I don't think Ranald McDonald I would pick as a navigator, you know, like I would say James Cook. But it allowed me to develop the tension in the book about what we do to each other because of race and what knowledge is lost to us.
I think I should probably ask one more question then open it up to all of you. One of the words that appears and reappears is despair. And I feel like your narrative pushing into three dimensions in each chapter is a kind of resistance to despair, and you're finding different ways to resist. Even use the word impotent despair, which just seems, you know, despair without a solution. And I in that story, you just the capsule biography that you just magically unfurled from your head of Ranald McDonald, you tell a story that essentially says that the solution to many of our problems is also in the problem. That, you know, if our society is racist, we cannot imagine the solutions to our problems because we're losing out on a great possible wealth of intelligence and imagination.
Yes.
And I wonder if there was any other dynamic like that in the book, in the travels, where you found the solution, or if not the expanding agent for questions right in plain sight, in something that was often labeled a problem.
I'm having trouble framing an answer to the question. I would say again that you know as a writer a lot about what you're doing, but certainly not everything. And there is a way, you know, everywhere I've gone for 40 years, I've asked traditional people, what do you mean, a storyteller? What does that person do? And are there different kinds of stories? And I've gotten wonderful answers down through the years that have helped me to define myself in my culture in a way that my culture doesn't define mostly what a writer does. So this was in Alice Springs in the Northern Territory. And there was a little shopping mall with an atrium of twice the size of this stage. And he and I were sitting in the sunshine. He was a Pintupi man. And I was trying to explain to him the differences between fiction and nonfiction. I could see how foolish it was, but, you know, if you persist in the foolishness, you'll get to something that's worth saving. So I explained how in the foundation for nonfiction is a factual truth, and that in fiction the foundation is emotional truth, and how these things were different. And he said, that wouldn't work for us. All right. So I said, how do you make a difference between stories, or distinguish among them that are serious stories, you know, life-saving stories? And he thought about that for a while, and he said, well, we would distinguish between an authentic story and an inauthentic story. And I said, well, what would an authentic story be? So we're sitting in this atrium, and he looked up, and there are other Pintupi people moving through the atrium. There are Pinjanjara people, there are Aranda people, there are white people, there are black people, you know, a whole mix. So he said, well, an authentic story is about us, you know, all human beings. And I said, well, what is an inauthentic story? And he said, an inauthentic story would be a story just about the person who wrote it. So I said, you know, we have that trouble in my country. So I've lost my tracking here, but...
So he wasn't a fan of Philip Roth?
No.
No.
But that would have been a good conversation to have. What I was looking for is, how does the thing, story, how does it help? What is the way in which it helps? And who tells those stories? A little bit like, who is the navigator and what is the conveyance? What is the story and who is the storyteller? The best definition I ever heard for a storyteller was from a man in Yellowknife. I don't remember what his tribal affiliation was, but he spoke Inuktitut, which is the Eskimo dialect of the Eastern Arctic, of Nunavut. And he said the storyteller is the person, we call that person Isumtok. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he gave me some kind of answer. And then I phoned a friend in the translation center in Fairbanks, and asked him, could he translate that word Isumtok for me? And so we went back and forth a little bit, and this is what we came up with. The person who creates the atmosphere in which wisdom reveals itself. So the burden is not, the storyteller is not the important person or thing. The important thing is the story and the way in which it elevates, soothes, and compels people to behave in a way that will help them take care of their children and that sort of thing. So when you ask me a question about what I'm doing as a storyteller, I do know what I'm trying to do. I'm very conscious of trying to create this enormous space in which people are free to think. I'm conscious that it is my intention to indict xenophobia and indict racism and to call up the places and the names, and so that there's some, you know, it's not a general remark, and not do it very often, you know, and people get tired of that. But I can see later, I can go to something that I've written and think, wow, I could have never said that, but, you know, I guess I did. So I can, when I have some distance from that book, I'll be able to go back and read it and think, wow, you know. Somebody told me once about Arctic Dreams. Arctic Dreams opens with a man, me, bowing toward a horned lark. And at the very end of the book on St. Lawrence Island, after we came back from hunting walrus, I made this bow toward the Strait of Anian, which we call Bering Strait. And several years later, somebody wrote and said, that was brilliant. Bowing to the horned lark at the beginning of the book and bowing in a completely different way to the Strait of Anian. And I thought, yeah. I wasn't aware of doing it, but all right. So that's what I mean. You're just an instrument, often, as a writer. I think when you're trying to write about serious things in a serious way with respect for the reader and indicate that you too are, in so much as any of us is at fault, are at fault too, that you're not exempt. You can't be in the I know, you don't know frame of mind with the reader. If that's going on, then something is coming in sideways through you that is the thing that has kept us going, all of us, for, you know, however many years you want to say we've been trying to get this right.
You're a fabulous instrument, Barry. Thank you for talking to us. There's a microphone floating around, and the gentleman with the baseball cap. If there's a question for Barry.
Thanks. Assuming all developed societies are racist, what are your thoughts on business and economic solutions? And please don't say education, because California post Proposition 98 mandates 40% of the state budget go to education, K-12. We have the most poverty in the entire country.
I'm not a philosopher, or a credible philosopher. I don't know what the answer to the question is, but I believe the conversation that has to be had is we can no longer afford for people to increase personal wealth. We cannot afford it. We cannot allow somebody with the wherewithal to dig for iron ore in Western Australia, which I talk about there, and take unto themselves the profit for it. It makes no sense, it's unethical, and it destroys everything that it makes us think we can get through what is coming, which is the diminution of natural resources and the deconcentration of wealth if we're going to survive. So, you know, that's not a policy. That's just an emotion. But it is an emotion that drives me when I write. We can't afford this anymore. We cannot have people sitting outside this building not knowing where the next piece of food is coming from while somebody else is fretting over over small things in their yacht that don't really work right all the time. We can't do that anymore. And what we're where we're sitting now is the Rubicon. We have to make this decision. Are we in this together, and are we going to look out for each other, or are we going to sequester the wealth, the material wealth, and keep it to ourselves and die alone? It is better that we look at each other, recognize that we are not, nor is anybody else, a culture that has rid itself of racism and xenophobia and selfishness, and say, we haven't done this, but we had better make a politics that is based on our having done that and begin that invention, or we're going to be caught in 20 or 30 years and we're all going to go under. You've got to think of your children, or in my case, my children and my grandchildren, and ensure that they have something to work with. Everybody knows hell is coming. Everybody already knows that. So what are you doing holding on to even more stuff for yourself? This is what an immature person does, not a grown-up. A man told me once when I asked him, what is a grown-up? He said, a grown-up is a person who no longer needs to be supervised. They can be counted on to do the right thing for everybody. They are no longer about themselves. They've gotten over themselves. They're here to take care of everybody, to have a loving relationship with everyone, which means founded on ethical behavior. So, sorry to rant, but...
Sorry, my question isn't as thought-provoking, but... I loved the Mappist, and so what was the inspiration for that? And I could identify with the North Dakota location, so what was the inspiration for the location? Thanks.
I think I've written 5 stories that are set in North Dakota. I don't know why. I haven't spent that much time there, but it haunts me. The North Dakota landscape haunts me, and that's why I'm always talking about Assiniboine and Arikara people who live there in the western part of the state. So it just took hold of my imagination, and when I began to think about something, it was inevitable sometimes that North Dakota would pop right up in my mind. The map is the story that you refer to is about a dedicated cartographer who worked for the federal government until he just got sick and tired of the bureaucracy, and then he continued to make maps. And the maps were brilliant, breathtaking, and nobody recognized how brilliant they were. And he began writing a series of books, and those books were the outgrowth of his fascination with the mapping of anything and how can it be done. You can't just put lines on a piece of paper. How can you create the whole thing, a kind of, what is that word, the equivalent, what is the equivalent of something, the imagined equivalent of something in parallel, in the parallel universe, whatever. His concern is that lies not be told, and that the thing, you show a respect for the landscape by making a very accurate depiction of what it is, a cityscape or a landscape that is, you know, in North Dakota. So when I was a boy, I wrote another story about another Mappist. So it's an idea that came back to me 30, 40 years later or something like that. But I remember, I can't really remember the story, but its linchpin was pettiness and how pettiness destroys or can destroy a life. In fact, it might be up somewhere in San Francisco now. There is a fine press limited edition book called The Mappist, which was created by a bookmaker in San Francisco named Charles Hobson. And it's one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen. I love working with him because I can show him a story, and if he really likes it and excites him, he'll make something I never thought of. And so much of what it seems to me important about art is to not own it, to recognize that you were given something and you turned it into language and you give it to another artist and that artist turns it into a three-dimensional object, and on and on and on. If the story is any good, it means people who never would have read the story have a way to get into it, have a way to find their way into it. That's what I mean about taking care of each other. Don't worry so much about how you are going to be remembered. We're all going to be forgotten. But if we can help each other come fully to life, then our children won't hate us.
John. Oh.
I really appreciate your discussions of racism, and I think that to deal with it honestly, it means that we as white people need to recognize our own racism and that we grew up in a racist society. So we have to get away from the white centeredness, the white apathy, the white supremacy, and we all have those things, but we don't want to admit it. And I want to recommend to your audience Layla Saad's 28-day challenge called Me and White Supremacy, which is free online.
Great. Thanks for the tip. I feel like I want to add, I know exactly what you're talking about. But you know what? In every corner of the world, I have met people who have found a way to live in equality, and they're white people. And we demonize ourselves to such an extent sometimes that we lose all power of volition and action. And there are, there's, how do I say this? In going into a village where that belongs to, was invented by, is owned by indigenous people, there's no way to get over the fact that, or get around the fact that you're white and you will never be, ever be like them. But you can begin an apprenticeship, and the enthusiasm with which you do that and your willingness to take the butt of a few jokes or be the butt of a few jokes because you're white carries a long way. And this isn't going to happen overnight. It's the determination to represent something deeper than your own race. And other people who know the history of racism, how destructive it is, will make common cause with you. So I agree with what you say, and I just want to say there are really some remarkable people in the world who happen to be white and are working hard to solve this problem. Because if we don't solve it, you know, we're all going to go down shooting each other or something. Thanks for the tip.
Hi, Barry. Thank you for talking to us today. You said something at Pacific University years ago that has stayed with me a long time about pattern making and writing. And I'm teaching Silco's Ceremony right now and thinking about the patterns in that book. And today you've really talked about space making rather than pattern making. And I'm just curious, is that an intentional slide from pattern making to space making, or are you still thinking about patterns?
No, they're going on at the same time. They're just two different ways of talking about it. I think what Pam is referring to is, I guess because it just irked me that people would separate writing, which is the most literal of the arts, from the other arts. There was the arts, and then there was writing down there somewhere. The position I guess I maintain is, and this comes from talking to other artists, about the way in which you don't know what you're doing, but in the way at the same time you do know what you're doing. And it's the arrangement of a pattern that makes something beautiful. Doesn't mean it's not terrifying, but beautiful in the sense that it's a very high level of coherence. So colors on canvas or the arrangement of tones in a piece of music, you're always messing with these patterns, create a pattern that makes something come alive in the listener or the reader. So I still think about that all the time and what it is that writing has in common with musical composition, for example. And I guess what I was writing about in Horizon or trying to do is create more room by the way the book is written for people to be at ease with their own ideas and their own ambition and their own sense of purpose in life. I think the thing you really hope for as a writer is that when someone finishes the book, they will have an enhanced sense of self-worth and a sense of possibility. If you can create an arrangement of words that makes the reader say, I see how difficult it all is, and you know what? I can do something about it in my world, and I'm beginning. If you get that, we're glad you were alive.
I'm afraid we've run out of time for questions, but you've been a very attentive and wonderful audience. Thank you, Barry Lopez. He's going to sign books outside. And thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.